John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, November 26, 2012. Israel continued to attack Gaza in violation of last week's truce deal, and in the West Bank, a date has been set to open the grave of late Palestinian President Yasser Arafat. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian medical sources reported that three Palestinians have been injured on Sunday evening after Israeli soldiers stationed across the borders opened fire at them in Al-Farahin area east of Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. The sources added that the army opened fire at several Palestinian farmers working in their land, an issue that led to three injuries, and forced the farmers to leave their lands. Israeli soldiers killed 2 days ago one Palestinian and wounded more than 19 others near the borders in Khan Yunis. The latest attacks are direct violations of the truce that was mediated by Egypt between Israel and the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. The truce, reached last Wednesday, ended 8 days of Israeli sea, air and ground bombardment on Gaza. The attacks left 165 killed and around 1,300 injured. In the West Bank city of Ramallah, Tawfiq Tirawi, head of the Palestinian committee that is investigating the assassination of Palestinian President Yasser Arafat, stated that Arafat's grave will be opened this coming Tuesday in order to examine his body for forensic analysis as part of the investigation into his death. Tirawi stated that the Palestinians and the Palestinian leadership have no doubt that Israel is behind Arafat's death, especially when taking into consideration that the Israeli military, security and political leaders openly called for his assassination when he was confined and surrounded at his headquarters in Ramallah. In other news, the Israeli Jerusalem municipality postponed a session to discuss the change of street names in the neighborhoods of Silwan and Suwana in accordance with the request of settlers who live in the municipality of Jerusalem. The Palestinian Information Center in Wadi Hilwa learned that the occupation municipality postponed the session, which was scheduled today, to discuss the names of the streets in the neighborhoods of Silwan and Suwana that the settlers have proposed, but without setting up a new date for the session. The Information Center also reported that the rescheduling of the hearing session was due to public pressure in the Silwan neighborhood from those who objected the change of the names of their streets with Talmudic names. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, November 26th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hossam Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Afghanistan, 24th of November. NATO is reporting the death of an American soldier from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, 26th of November. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality from an IED blast in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, 26th of November. At least 19 people were wounded in a bicycle bomb attack in the eastern Afghan city of Khost. Afghanistan, 26th of November. Unknown fighters bombed a police mobile van near a Chidi checkpost here, but no casualties were reported. A weak detonation was reported. Afghanistan, 25th of November. 9 rockets were fired from Afghanistan into Pakistan, landing in South Waziristan. They were fired from the Shateen area of Paktia province, an area recently abandoned by NATO troops and turned over to Afghan government forces. No casualties were reported. Afghanistan, 24th of November. A private TV channel reported that 20 mortar shells were fired into Pakistan from Afghanistan. They landed near Angkor Ada in Zilbapahara areas in the border region. One of them destroyed a vehicle, but no human casualties were reported. Pakistani officials have filed diplomatic protests over the cross-border shelling and rocket fire. Afghanistan, 23rd of November. A suicide car bomber killed 3 people and wounded dozens near a NATO-run training base on Friday in an attack claimed by the Taliban as revenge for the execution of 4 of their militants. 90 people were wounded, including minor wounds of several NATO soldiers. The Taliban claimed the attack as vengeance for the hanging of 4 of their fighters on charges ranging from rape to murder at a prison in Kabul. Afghanistan, 22nd of November. 2 police constables were killed after fighters armed with medium machine guns and RPG-7 rocket launchers attacked the Spin Kabar outpost of Badabur police and paramilitary forces. This was the first broad daylight attack on a checkpost in that area. Afghanistan, 21st of November. Dinner for 30 police officers at a base in Khasar district of Faryab province came with an extra helping of poison. One of the cops died and 29 more became unconscious after eating food poisoned by an unknown attacker. Afghanistan, ongoing. The New York Times cites an anonymous source inside the Obama administration as saying about 10,000 U.S. troops may stay in Afghanistan after the so-called International Security Assistance Force leaves in 2014. Mr. Barack Obama, a Washington Post editorial on the 25th of November stated that a small U.S. presence in Afghanistan, anything under about 65,000 troops, would be limited to defending its own bases. Now is the time to pull all the troops out of Afghanistan, not just some of them. Bring all the troops home today.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Red.
children in rags, welfare reform, let them eat cake. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shop and malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too. The shop and malls just to pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too. Bye, 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 bye. Rich pigeons for his children and rags, welfare reform, let them be kicked. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shop and malls just to pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too.
On the 26th of November, Mayor Gray's Chief of Staff Chris Murphy sent an insulting email to residents of the CCNV shelter organized under a group called SHARC around homeless advocacy. Mayor Gray, like Jack Evans, has been blowing off all efforts by homeless advocates to arrange a meeting to discuss shelter funding for the year and other issues affecting the poor. Infuriated CCNV residents responded by marching on City Hall.
So here's the deal. The mayor's chief of staff, a guy named Chris Murphy, he emailed me on November 16th. I had never heard of the guy before that day. I didn't know he existed. And he said to me in the email that I think you have the wrong information about the mayor's priorities in terms of schools and charter schools and parks and so forth. And he said, if you want to come down and have a civil meeting with us, you know, or with me, you know, I'm willing to meet with you. And he entitled his email an offer. Okay, so I took him up on that offer and I said, we don't just shout and shoot. We aren't just rebels without a cause. And we'll go down and talk to you. And then I found this blog post that explains all his policies and how they hurt the poor. I emailed that around, and so anyway, you know, I said, well, maybe this is what he's referring to, you know, and he got insulted, and he said that I was disrespectful to him. So he and I had a real sharp exchange this morning via email, and he actually called off the, or he didn't call it off, but he said he might call off the meeting he's going to have with SHARC on Wednesday in 2 days. You know, and so anyway, we're going to make a video real fast and put it out to him and let him know that we're galvanizing and that if he is unprofessional like that, it's going to look real bad for him because a public official should not get that easily insulted. I didn't call him any names. I was real nice. I didn't curse him out. I was absolutely nice in the email and he got insulted anyway.
In response to this outrageous insult, CCNV shelter residents in SHARC vowed to bum rush City Hall in a chant during the March 2 City Hall.
Say what? Bum rush City Hall! We're gonna bum rush City Hall!
Say what?
Bum rush City Hall! We're gonna bum rush City Hall!
Say what?
All right.
Yeah.
I'm glad everybody came out, and I want to tell y'all that Councilman Jim Graham, who has oversight of human services, has said multiple times, you know, I see the same five advocates down here all the time. What if we have 7,000 homeless, why aren't more of them here?
Thank you!
So, now, here we are in larger numbers. And we're going to get even larger next month, okay? We're going to keep on growing, but for now, let's try to be peaceful, okay? Even though they pissed me off this morning, the mayor's office, we're still going to be nice today.
We got babies.
I'm going to be nice.
And
so let's give them a chance.
ask you to cooperate with us. Let's tell them our demands. Speak from your heart and what we want. You want affordable housing. You want living wage jobs. Let them know, okay? And if they don't make good, next time we're going to come back and rap. But this time around, let's be nice about it, okay?
All right.
And that's me saying that, and I'm known to be nasty. DC Johnson, okay? So let's go on it.
As this goes to airtime, the outcome of the meeting that Shark and CCNV shelter residents demanded at City Hall is not known. Mayor Gray, however, has a well-earned reputation, and not just among housing and homeless advocates, as a smooth criminal.
You've been hit by a smooth criminal.
A week before Black Friday, the launch of the Christmas shopping season, Walmart warehouse workers in California went on a one-day strike to protest growing harassment at Walmart's supply hubs and retail outlets. For the first time in its 50-year history, Walmart faces widespread labor unrest and protest by a number of union-supported groups complaining about work conditions. Seafood workers were the first to walk out in June. In early October, Walmart workers in 12 states launched a one-day strike, and 200 workers crashed a Walmart shareholders meeting in Bentonville, Arkansas. The momentum continued with labor protests on Black Friday, fueled by anger at the giant retailer for opening its doors on Thanksgiving evening, spoiling the holiday for many workers. The striking workers belong to a number of groups, including Organization United for Respect at Walmart, or Our Walmart, and Warehouse Workers for Justice. They are not seeking union recognition, but action on poor working conditions and a halt to the harassment of activists. Workers have the right to strike over unfair labor violations, a right Walmart has recognized. Historically, Walmart has taken a very hard line against unions. When Texas meat cutters won a union election in 2000, Walmart eliminated that position in all its stores. With low wages and a weak company-sponsored health insurance plan, families of California's Walmart workers are 40% more likely than other retail workers to rely on publicly funded health care and be eligible for public assistance.
On November the 23rd, Black Friday, workers walked out of Walmart stores all over the U.S. Here in D.C., striking Walmart associates joined with labor activists to march on a number of Walmarts around D.C. Hundreds appeared at the Walmart in Laurel, and five busloads of protesters departed from a union hall in Prince George's County, deploying to a number of different Walmart stores. One participant in the buses that left the UFCW Union Hall was on a bus that deployed to a Walmart for an in-store mic check, much to the consternation of Walmart's managers. Here's how it went down as told by a participant who used to work at Walmart in New Mexico.
I went out to New Carrollton at the end of the orange line that was at the UFCW Union Hall, and there were, let's see, five buses full of people. And the bus I was on was kind of reserved for experienced activists.
And that was the bus that went to the mic check action?
Yeah, the first action, where all five buses went, was essentially a march. And it just marched around the whole shopping center where the Walmart was.
Here's what things sounded like as five busloads of protesters marched around the Walmart.
We say fight back.
That's hundreds of people chanting, "They say roll back, we say fight back." According to our participant, who formerly worked at Walmart, the march pretty much kept their distance when asked to by police in order to avoid creating problems for associates still working inside.
Didn't go very near the Walmart.
Was that the one on Route 450 where cops were reported to keep people away?
There weren't enough cops there really to keep people away if they didn't want to. It was kind of being run in such a way as they didn't want to look like the bad guys. The march was kind of soft, you know. There was maybe 250 people and just marched around the Walmart, and there was a lot of yelling and stuff. And then our bus went to a second target in Severn, and in that one, it looked like they saw us coming. Looked like they knew we were coming, so they had a few cops there, but there was one entrance that they didn't block off, and so our bus stopped right next to that. We all unloaded out and went through the garden department.
Ooh.
And into the Walmart and up where the cash registers were. And then we did a pre-written mic check. It was a mic check. It was on paper, and the person doing the mic checking read it.
We are here today.
We are here today.
In support of Walmart Associates.
In support of Walmart Associates.
We are here in support.
We are here in support.
The organization United for Respect.
The organization United for Respect.
We are standing with those.
We are standing with those.
Who are refusing to work today.
Who are refusing to work today.
And stores across the country.
And stores across the country.
According to the former Walmart associate, WSQT interviewed about this protest, the cops inside Walmart weren't too happy about the mic check.
And then the cops kind of converged on us. They were threatening to arrest people, and they were getting kind of pushy. So once the mic check was finished, we just chanted, "We'll be back, we'll be back." We started marching out of there. One of the individuals actually talked to a lot of people in there. A lot of the customers were actually glad to see it happening. And to the extent that they could, some of the employees were approving of it. There was somebody from The Nation, the magazine The Nation there.
Yeah.
And he was taking pictures, doing a little bit of video. And the manager got all up in his face, told him he couldn't video here, and the guy from The Nation just kind of ignored him.
Yeah, I had the same thing happen at a fur shop protest where someone tried to tell me I couldn't shoot video.
Yeah, and then the manager went to the cops to tell them they weren't allowed to use video there, and the cop didn't seem to feel that that was something that he was going to get into.
That's also consistent with what I had at the fur shop.
Yeah, I think something like that would be a civil suit. The police wouldn't be involved in that. And I doubt whether it would go very far. We exited out, and we went back in the bus, went back to Union Hall, and being in Union Hall, and therefore having much more money than most of us poor activists, they had a monstrous amount of pizza waiting for us. And they had been doing this. This isn't the first one they did it with. They had done walkthroughs and mic checks in various different Walmarts all through the week.
I heard about that. One woman that was interviewed at one of the Walmart protests by TV7 said that she'd been forced to work on Thanksgiving, so now she was walking out.
Good. Good. there were a lot of the people who were with us were actually people who had walked out. My understanding is they've got them to where Walmart is in a legal bind that they can't fire them, okay?
There's been lots of talk of retaliation.
The organization is actually called Our Walmart.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them.
Yeah, it's not like a union in as far as the NLRA nowadays defines a union.
Which gives them more flexibility.
It's actually reminds me a lot more of the old-fashioned solidarity unions.
Hmm.
You know? So it's a good thing. I think it's a very good development.
And the idea for Walmart of having strikes and protests on Black Friday has got to get their hackles up.
Yeah, it was angry.
Yeah. What do you think the odds are that since they can't fire the strikers, they'll try to order them all to work on Christmas and New Year's as a way of retaliation?
I don't know. I worked at Walmart for about 4 months in New Mexico. They did some pretty nasty stuff. I mean, they fired somebody for taking off for the funeral of a son-in-law who had been killed in Afghanistan.
Ooh!
I mean,
they did that?
Stuff like that. Yeah, they were pretty nasty.
And were they flying an American flag outside their store while they fired somebody for taking time off for a military funeral?
Yeah. Well, actually, they're going to take 2 weeks off to be with their daughter because it was her husband.
Who was killed in Afghanistan, and then Walmart flying an American flag outside their store fires somebody over that.
Yeah, they don't care. Yeah, they'd fire you if you're out more than 4 days sick.
Hmm.
If you got sick, you're out more than 4 days. I mean, not paid 4 days, unpaid.
Yeah.
One guy was there, coughing his head off, and he was ordered to... He wasn't allowed to go home or he'd be fired. And if he kept coughing, they were going to fire him.
How many other people got sick because of that?
Yeah, that was what I was trying to say. But on the other hand, yeah, it's kind of weird because I kind of had him somehow in a little bit of a legal bind. Because, yeah, I would stand at my cash register and I'd have an AFL-CIO neck thing holding my Walmart ID that I got at the DNC, and I'd have my IWW red card right with my ID and an IWW button on, and I'd actually sing Solidarity Forever right at the cash register. And somehow that put them in a legal bind where they didn't dare do anything. But unfortunately, when I tried to pursue that and push what I found to be a sort of a legal conundrum for them, I was unable to continue. I had some life changes and I had to move on. In fact, when I quit, because they said I was training for traveling, they said I was rehirable.
And that just goes to show you that even the mighty Walmart, the creeps that think they can get away with anything, understand power. Even Walmart understands the power of the union, the power of the strike, the power of the walkout, the power of the boycott. If anybody asks you why you should boycott Walmart, why you should help keep DC Walmart free, just remember this. Walmart, always low wages. Always. Walmart, rolling back wages.
Shame on you.
On the 23rd of November, Black Friday, also known as Fur Free Friday, close to 50 protesters from the Anti-Fur Society showed up lining the streets in front of Garten House Furs in Bethesda, Maryland. All the fur customers entering or leaving the store, and there really weren't very many of those, had to run a gauntlet of protesters trying to educate them on the suffering implicit in buying a fur coat. One of the protesters even carried deceased anti-fur activist Walt Raves' dead fox in a trap that he used to carry at protests against fur as long ago as the late 1990s to remind all the fur buyers what they were really paying for when they buy a fur coat.
In order to make one 40-inch coat, it takes 42 red foxes. There's a fox here in this trap I'm holding. I'm not sure if he's a red fox or not. But he valued his life, and it took 40 like him to make one 40-inch coat. 126 non-target animals, and they spend 2,520 hours languishing in the trap in pain, waiting for death. In order to make one 40-inch coat, it takes 40 raccoons, 120 non-target animals, and they spend 2,400 hours waiting for death in a trap.
That's the real cost of fur. Animals suffering in traps, not knowing what's happening to them, waiting to die for vanity, or maybe waiting in cages in a factory farm their whole lives for the same fate of being skinned alive, anally or vaginally electrocuted, or stomped to death. So I've got only one thing to say to you if you're wearing a fur coat. On the 23rd of November, Black Friday, also known as Fur Free Friday, in addition to the large protest at Garten House Furs, there was a second smaller protest at Miller's Furs just up the street.
The owner of Miller's Furs, Manny Miller, had a reputation at fur protests in the 90s as liking to fight. What happened on the 23rd of November 2012 seemed to bear that out. There was a pasty-faced manager, possibly the owner, who was very unhappy that protesters opened the door and yelled into the store. There weren't many customers to bother, but there may have been one or two.
Freedom, animal rights!
One struggle, one fight!
Human freedom, animal rights!
One struggle, one fight!
Yeah, okay, Kia.
All right,
okay,
this is your sidewalk, eight Miller. Private problem.
Hey, Millers, what do you say? How did you murder your first today?
Gassing, trapping, anal electrocution!
This was a new location for Miller's Furs, but protesters found them as quickly as customers did.
Doesn't matter where you go! We will find you! We will be out here, naming and shaming you, until you close down your store for good! Your whole store is built on the blood of innocent animals! No compromise for the animals, no compromise for you, and you're selling a blood money.
You want to be skinned alive? No! So why would you sell skin? You want to be scared? No!
Okay, I'm asking this gentleman,
please
get off the
private
property.
He is off. Don't you see? Yes, he is.
Please get off.
Yes, he is.
Come on.
Yes, he is! Stop being obsessed about it!
Like I said, Miller's Furs and Manny Miller love to fight. This has been true as far back as the 1990s. This time around on the 23rd of November, they came out on the sidewalk to argue with protesters on public property, claiming falsely that protesters were on private property. There was an incident in the 1990s when Miller's Furs was blocked from view from the street at a long-closed location in Washington, D.C. by construction. So, fur protest by Compassion Over Killing, which organized fur protests in those days, took place at another fur shop down the street. It was August. It was almost 100 degrees out. And what did Manny Miller do? He had one of his employees put on a fur coat on a hot August day in Washington, D.C., and walk down the street to argue with fur protesters. The cops threatened to charge him with inciting the riot for that. That's the history of Manny Miller and Miller's Furs. So it's not surprising they'd come out and argue with people on the sidewalk.
We do job and join us!
You are the real criminal!
Minister! We will come back!
So until next time! Until all are free!
We'll be back!
We'll be back! We'll be back!
That's not a threat. That's a promise Miller's Furs can take to the bank. Miller's Furs has been the target of protests back to the mid-1990s, and the only thing that can ever stop it is for Miller's Furs to stop selling the skins of animals that were tortured to death for vanity.
Occupy Wall Street and related groups through InterOccupy have taken on a major relief effort called Occupy Sandy in the wake of the superstorm that hit the East Coast in late October. Volunteers in the New York City area coordinated their efforts from two central hub sites in Brooklyn and fanned out all over the city. They assisted people in neighborhoods that were without power and heat some more than 2 weeks after the storm hit, as the November days grew colder and darker. Another dimension of Occupy's Hurricane Sandy relief work was the building of bridges between the movement and diverse communities, where discussions turned to politics and economics. Many people in the communities impacted by the storm and Occupy organizers reached common ground in thinking about the urgent need to address climate change that produces dangerous storms like Sandy, as well as concern that developers may soon move to convert storm-damaged affordable housing units on the shoreline into luxury homes or expensive condominiums. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Pablo Benson Silva, the coordinator of one of two Occupy hub sites in Brooklyn. He talks about how the relief effort was organized, the role of social media, the massive scale of the all-volunteer-run organization, and the connection between standing up to the 1% and standing up to storms made more devastating by climate change.
Our job here is to make sure we match drivers with volunteers and supplies and take it out to different sites that we've opened and the most affected areas. Right now that we're talking about Far Rockaway, Coney Island, Staten Island, Sheepheads Bay. These areas, I just went out yesterday to Far Rockaway and they're just devastated. The destruction, the scale of it is pretty overwhelming. So as the week has progressed, we've been opening up new sites closer to underserved communities. Right now, the big kind of story coming out is that both FEMA, Office for Emergency Management, Red Cross, all these kind of institutional disaster relief players have been kind of dropped the ball. And we as a kind of makeshift network of non-paid volunteers have actually outrolled a network that has rivaled their response. We've been able to get aid volunteers, cleanup crews out into these most devastated areas very quickly. And I think it has a lot to do with kind of social media savvy of the Occupy movement brings to the equation, and just kind of the enthusiasm and capacity to do multitasking and being at the same time compassionate, right? And kind of community building experience that Occupy brings to the equation. So yeah, so far it's been amazing, the response in terms of volunteers, that aren't necessarily affiliated with Occupy. People have just been are very anxious to help in any way possible. And the good thing about Occupy is that we've been able to figure out how volunteers can, through just quick orientations and kind of self-motivation and initiative, can do very meaningful work in this relief effort. Occupy manages two distribution sites. Need assessments we do with our branches on the ground. We send out volunteer supplies and drivers on a daily basis. I'd say during the weekend is when we get most of our volunteers this weekend. We probably process through this site alone close to 5,000 volunteers, and I can't even count the cars. We're finally taking track of all this so that we have a better idea of how we're scaling gradually, because this has just been kind of ad hoc operation so far.
Well, is anybody, I mean, I know you're Occupy's a famously non-hierarchical organization, but is there anybody in charge, or is it a pyramid, or is it just totally horizontal?
So I think the way it's worked actually is it's been a kind of organic structure that has emerged based on need. I think one of the amazing things about this movement, this operation, is that it's a real meritocracy. Anybody who can bring a broad skill base and who has time to commit to this operation, extended period of time, immediately gets plucked at for organizing and coordination. So yes, obviously we have organizers and coordinators, but it's a kind of step up, step down approach, right? Where people don't get too comfortable in organizing positions, and they're moved around frequently. So there's a lot of turnover. I mean, people have other responsibilities besides this hurricane relief, right? And so we're always constantly switching out coordinators or constantly switching out. So yeah, I mean, that's one of the amazing things. You can say Occupy is a leaderless, but you can also say it's a leaderful movement, right? And we kind of encourage people to take initiative, and people with leadership skills immediately find a space for themselves here.
I'm staying with some friends my friend has a friend who has a brother who's trader people on Wall Street. He's setting up his own thing with his own money and, getting volunteers to come, but really coordinating it all in the far rock, somewhere in the Rockaways. And he specifically wants to show that he's a libertarian or something, that we don't need government. So what do you think this incredible effort by Occupy, what will that show?
People ask me, well, how is it that, Occupy is now doing Sandy relief? And I think Occupy, since the beginning, has been doing disaster relief. It was doing disaster relief of the financial crisis, right? and getting people involved again in politics beyond electoral politics, right? In terms of direct action on the streets and organizing in their communities. I think there is room for people to do autonomous action, right? And this aid relief effort is an autonomous action, right? What Occupy represents, perhaps, is a kind of new paradigm shift that shows that you don't necessarily always need this top-down approach towards relief and just community organizing more generally, right? So I think, if anything, governments should learn from, and you know, institutional charity organizations and NGOs should learn from this approach, right, if they want to be more effective.
That was Pablo Benson Silva, a volunteer with the Occupy Wall Street Hurricane Sandy relief effort. For more information on Occupy's relief efforts, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.